Opinions expressed in our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
All right. Hello, everybody. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and thanks for listening tonight. This is Defiant Hustle Radio, and we have a nice day in here. It's hot. My office was boiling hot all day, and so at least now I'm in the studio, and it's cool in here, and we're going into a nice July 4th holiday. And speaking of July 4th, I have on a political guest and a fantastic woman. She's in the studio with me now. So I would like everybody to welcome Connecticut State Senator Alex Bergstein. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much, Noreen. I'm delighted to be here.
Good. So thanks for being here, because I know it's a night that most people are out and trying to get started with their holidays. Mm-hmm. But you and I were just talking a little bit before the show, and I was telling you, well, I'm not a journalist. I am fascinated by politics. Who could not be now? I don't look at Connecticut politics as much, simply because just keeping an eye on what's going on the national and international scene is just perplexing.
Yes.
It's you actually have to step away from it.
Yes.
For a second. But this is the second time you've been on our show, so I appreciate mm-hmm. that. And I did dig in for a long time to try and prepare myself, mm-hmm. and at the risk of getting overwhelmed, when you and I were talking before the show, I was pleased that you wanted to discuss educate some of the people that are listening, and then discuss some of the things that are taking place, some of the bills that have just passed, what
sure.
have not passed.
Well, politics is an education for everyone. And the only way that I think government works is when we are truly all engaged. And that, of course, means being informed, getting our facts from reliable sources, and really participating in the process, which doesn't mean just going to vote once every 4 years or 2 years or even once a year, but really understanding what your elected officials are doing on your behalf. So, I can talk about what we have accomplished this year in the legislature, but first I just thought it would be interesting to share how the process works, because a lot of people don't know this, and as a first-time legislator, it was eye-opening. So this year,
so you just for our listeners' sake, because I know it,
yeah.
you beat the incumbent, who mm-hmm. was a five-term incumbent,
yeah.
And so you really started going to work in January.
Yes, we were sworn in on January 9th. I started work the day after the election because
yes.
I wanted to be as prepared and knowledgeable as possible. And what I started doing the day after the election was reaching out and meeting with every elected official in the towns that I cover to really do a deep dive into their issues and meeting with everybody in those communities that I could, because my job as an elected official is to represent my community, my district, which includes all of Greenwich, part of New Canaan, and part of Stanford. But really, the higher level duty is to represent the state and to fix our state. So one part of my mission is to help us all think holistically,
okay.
and not just about our own town, our own street, our own community, whatever that is. Because if we all think just in terms of, you know, we are islands, then we're not really going to solve the big problems in our state. And unfortunately, that's traditionally how politics work, is that elected official, if they just pay attention to their district and sort of give, don't want to say kickbacks, but, you know, if they just bring some gifts back to their community, that somehow that's enough to just get reelected. And I think that's unfortunate, because that leads to very short-term and superficial policies. Mm-hmm. And we obviously are in a state of crisis in this state, and we need long-term solutions and bold action to get there. We can't just keep doing this two-year cycle of politicking. So I went to Hartford with a different kind of mission, which was not about one party versus another party, but right. really about finding and advancing the proven solutions to our biggest problems in the state. So it's very easy, and this is what has happened in many times in the past, it's very easy for legislators to put their name on a bill that, you know, does a little something nice that everyone can agree on. Okay, great. Like, we all want whatever it is, you know, something small and non-controversial. That's nice, and that may get people reelected because mm-hmm. they're not taking a hard position.
Right.
But I don't think that that really defines leadership. I think leadership means having the courage to find solutions, to bring the facts, the whole facts, the whole right. explanation.
The truth.
Right, the truth, which is not always, it's not black or white.
Right.
Like, there's, you know, there's a cost and benefit to everything. But to present that in a nonpartisan way to the public, so that everybody can make informed decisions and we can move together as an informed electorate and move forward.
I want to come back to leadership, but yeah. you were talking about crisis, the state right now being in a state of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Why is our state in a state of crisis?
Well, first of all, let me just reassure people. We are yep. moving away from a state of crisis. We are moving towards stability and sound fiscal policies that will actually turn our state around and generate the kind of economic stability that we all want. We're moving in that direction. It's like moving, you know, like 10-ton cruise ship. Like, it doesn't just spin around 180 degrees. We have to move it incrementally, but we're definitely moving in the right direction. So that's good news. But we are still in a state of crisis because
financial crisis.
Yes. Because the state has been mismanaged for many years. And again, it's because of that sort of short-term political cycle and short-term political thinking. Things like the unfunded pension liabilities were just sort of kicked down the road. Oh, let the next administration deal with that. You know, covering things up rather than exposing the hard truth, I think, is a failure of leadership. So I don't want to, you know, paint a rosy picture that everything's great and perfect. No, it's not. But we are definitely moving in the right direction. So we got a lot accomplished this session. Definitely have a lot more work to do, and so I am pleased but not satisfied.
Can I just stick with the I was telling you also before we started the show that I come out of private equity finance, mm-hmm. real estate finance, and so I was preparing for the show, so I was looking at the history of how Connecticut went from being an agricultural state.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became a manufacturing state, and then it became one of the places you could go to when you didn't want to live in New York City,
mm-hmm.
before New York City was maybe safe, but yeah. you had to go there, or you wanted to go there to work, or before it was, there was more crime or something in New York
yeah.
City. So Connecticut's beautiful, and it has the infrastructure, and so people moved here. And then the hedge funds and the finance funds took off. One article I was reading compared the state of finance, which is primarily the pension fund, right?
Our fiscal crisis. Yes, primarily.
Okay, so it compared it to when you're doing really well,
mm-hmm.
and you take out money on your credit card,
mm-hmm.
and you keep postponing paying it off
exactly.
because you're expecting things to go as well as it did before. But maybe the crisis, yeah. the Great Recession, really might have taken its toll. Definitely mm-hmm. sounds like it took its toll on Connecticut to some extent. So there wasn't enough money coming back in. And then we kept postponing it.
I would say that's part of the problem. Okay. There are many facets of the problem. Another part of the problem is that the benefits that were promised to state employees were exceedingly generous, and they just keep getting more generous. So even this year, even in this session, even in this state of fiscal crisis, we had to vote on increases in salary and benefits for different categories of state employees. Everything from public defendants to correctional officers. And those are really tough votes, because I do think that people who haven't had a raise in 10 years probably deserve a raise, especially if they're doing public service. However, I voted against every one of those contracts, because I do not think that in this current state we have the luxury of being able to increase state spending when we haven't gotten our complete fiscal house in order. So, but what you just alluded to, I thought was so interesting. How people migrated here, and like 40 years ago, and office parks were built, and people were moving out of the city, companies were moving out of the city and locating here, and, you know, being in an office park in a leafy suburb was so desirable. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, lifestyles have shifted, the business environment has shifted. Obviously, you know, digital is exists now and didn't exist 40 years ago. So we're in a very different economy, and we need to adapt to that economy. So I have talked to many business owners and employees, and asked them, both who live here and work here and those who don't live here and work here, what would make you come to Connecticut? Mm-hmm. What's inhibiting your growth as a business? And they all say it's transportation infrastructure, because we look out on 95, and any time of day or night you drive on 95, it seems there's always traffic. And I was driving at 2:15 this afternoon at 4 miles an hour on our highway. That's unacceptable for business. No businesses are going to move here with those conditions. So there's a lot that we can do to bring to create the conditions that will draw businesses here. They don't want to be in the office parks anymore. They want to be near train stations and highways. People are commuting. We need much better mass transit. And people also want to live in a more pedestrian-friendly zone, like in downtowns and near mass transit, so they can get around quickly and have access to, you know, entertainment and restaurants, et cetera. So, you know, living patterns, lifestyles, and business has evolved, and we need to catch up.
I was also reading, but there's some what they're describing as a movement to go south, west, or cheap. And that, especially for younger people, I'm going to say it's around the age of 35 or so, that they're moving back towards Brooklyn, if they're even staying in the Northeast, or they're going to places in the Carolinas or
Arizona. It's interesting you say that, because I've actually met a few people who've moved here from Brooklyn, and I'm so thrilled, because I think we need more Brooklyn here, and actually the cost of living here is better than it is in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is becoming extremely expensive. And our taxes are lower here. So we have a lot of attributes. We have a lot of selling points in Connecticut. Obviously, we love it. We live here.
Gorgeous.
It is gorgeous. So what I want to do is make Connecticut cool. And it really should be. We have the most desirable location in between Boston and New York. I mean, it's, if we had the modern infrastructure that we should have, if we had the fast trains that we could have, you could get from Stanford to Grand Central in 30 minutes. Imagine that. Imagine if we had that, which is entirely feasible, how many more people who work in Manhattan would want to live out here in Connecticut, who would buy houses. You know, our real estate market is really suffering. But if people could get here in 30 minutes, they would actually want to buy houses here, because everything else is beautiful about Connecticut, and the education, the homes, the towns.
The Long Island Sound. There is infrastructure here where you don't get that in just
any state. It's the transportation infrastructure that is decades behind where it should be.
And in bad shape.
It has been quantified. We are the 41st worst infrastructure in the country, 41st worst. So that's a credential that we don't want to have. We should be in the top 10 at least. So, but there's a solution. So like any complex problem, the solution is not simple, mm-hmm. but it is clear. And so I have proposed from the very beginning of the session, even during the campaign, I proposed a two-part solution, a new revenue source. We need more money for transportation, to invest in our roads and rails and to get that 30-minute train from Stanford to New York, which we could have. We also need a new mechanism for how we spend money, because pouring more money into our Department of Transportation without changing how they spend it and the system of decision-making mm-hmm. is not a good idea. We can't really trust the agency alone. I don't know if people realize this, but the way that infrastructure projects are green-lighted is a political decision. So the legislature and Department of Transportation communicate and they decide what the list of priority projects are. So as you can imagine, a legislator who's been there for 10, 15 years says, hey, it's my turn. I want that bridge and wherever it is. And mm-hmm. okay, because of their seniority, they get their bridge. But that doesn't mean that bridge was really the best way to spend Connecticut tax dollars. What we need is a way to do an objective, fact-based economic assessment mm-hmm. of every infrastructure need in the state, and then prioritize those needs according to what will deliver the best return on our tax dollars, which is going to generate the most economic growth. This is how other states do it. It's totally feasible. We have to expose the system for what it is, which is political. It again goes back to what I was talking about in the beginning. Politicians on their 2-year or 4-year cycle want to bring the bacon back home to their district, and say, I got that bridge done. Okay, but at what cost? What did it cost the state? And what didn't get done because you brought that back to your district? So we need a holistic mechanism for determining the priorities for our state. And that's the infrastructure bank, which I proposed.
Okay, so you're going in there. No. So I'm with you, mm-hmm. and you. So you go and so you go to Hartford.
Yeah.
Do you spend every day in Hartford? Not every day, but do you spend most of your days in Hartford?
Between January, so session started on January 10th. Actually, we were sworn in on the 9th. It ended at midnight, precisely at midnight on June 5th, and. For the first few months, what we were doing was we were meeting as committees. So everyone in the Senate is the chair of a committee. So, for instance, I'm chair of the Banking Committee and vice chair of Judiciary and also Transportation, which are really big committees. So you are in committee meetings all the time. And every single bill that gets proposed by a legislator, by an agency, by the governor sometimes, has to go through a committee process. And if it gets it's called JAFT, but basically if it gets green-lighted by the committee, maybe it'll get a public hearing, maybe it'll change, it'll morph, maybe it'll just get thrown in the trash. So that process of winnowing down the bills takes a few months, and then in like late April, early May, we start sort of actually voting on things. But that the process of deciding what actually will come to the floor for a vote is, as you can imagine, highly political. So we had a lot of really interesting moments. Like, for instance, there was a moment in late May when we, the Senate, wanted to vote on, well, the Democrats in the Senate wanted to vote on paid family medical leave. Mm-hmm. And the governor said, I'll veto it if you vote on it. And we met in our caucus room and we decided we're voting on it tonight. And if he wants to veto it, that's his choice. Of course, he backed down and he did not veto it because it was a really good bill and he ran on paid family medical leave. But that's the kind of like drama that can happen. And then as the countdown gets tighter and tighter, we get closer and closer to June 5th, we spend more and more time there. I wanted to stay there till midnight every night, and I wanted to start at 8 a.m. the next morning. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. There's a lot of time where we just are sitting around waiting for the negotiations between the two parties about what will come to the floor or not. And that's a whole art form.
Okay, I want to come back to something. No, it's fascinating, and I'm so glad that I spent time looking mm-hmm. at the makeup of the state in terms of, I guess there's like 61% of the, I want to say the Senate, party affiliation, makeup of the Senate is 61% Democratic and 39%.
Right, so we're 22, in this session, we're 22 Democrats and 14 Republicans, but a year ago it was 18-18, 18 Democrats, 18 Republicans. So a year ago it was very difficult to get really anything passed. They did pass the bipartisan budget, which all the Democrats voted for too, and I'm glad they did because we have a few checks and balances now that we didn't have before, like spending cap, volatility cap in the budget. So but now that it's 22-14, we are able to do more. And but I just want to loop back to the infrastructure bank because that's an example of something that actually was originally, like 25 years ago, originally a Republican idea because it creates fiscal discipline. It brings in private sector financing. So it allows you – it's basically a revolving fund that allows you to take – some public money and multiply it by leveraging it with private finance. So you can do much bigger deals at much lower cost, much faster. It's the modern way to finance infrastructure. Florida, South Carolina, all these others, Rhode Island, all these other states are using it, and they're saving billions of dollars.
So you're taking public money.
Yeah.
And you're basically getting loans, right, from private institutions? You're
yeah.
leveraging it in,
yeah, what you're doing is you're doing projects that have a revenue source. So you're taking that revenue, whatever it is, and that becomes the return for the investor. So the investor gives a lot of money up front, so you can build your bridge, you can build your port, you can build your tunnel
mm-hmm.
That you want to build, and then the revenue of people, you know. Coming through it, whatever it is, the fee that they pay to go through the tunnel, mm-hmm. The fee that they pay to dock in this brand new port becomes that's the revenue, that's the return for the investor.
So that's like building a building where you're going to either
rent
lease it out or
exactly.
hotel or something like that. So you have to build it up front.
Exactly.
Or rebuild it as the case may
yeah.
be. And so you leverage it within expectation that at a certain point you will make back a return on your investment, pay back your lender,
exactly.
or whatever the negotiation arrangements have been, whatever the contract arrangements are.
That's exactly
Pay it back to them. And then after that, presuming it's doing well, after that, it's going to
yeah, it brings
keep
a
bringing revenue
it
in.
It keeps bringing revenue, exactly.
And then you have to maintain it.
And so the fund keeps growing, and it requires some public funding up front,
uh-huh.
but then eventually it becomes self-sustaining because it just keeps bringing revenue also
right.
back
like
to
even a rental property, something very simple.
Exactly.
It's just like a rental property.
Yeah.
So it seems like common sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it seems like common sense. It allows public-private partnerships. It makes government more accountable so that dynamic that I described before about how our infrastructure projects are done just basically with a government agency that is not accountable to voters
mm-hmm.
and legislators. It's a political process. The only way to break that open is to create this public-private, quasi-public agency, which would be the infrastructure bank, that would have oversight and that would say, okay, wait a minute. Instead of just giving out infrastructure projects as political favors, mm-hmm. we're actually going to do real economic assessment, determine which projects make the most sense to finance, which will bring the most revenue, the most economic growth to the state. And then they go out to the private capital markets
mm-hmm.
and market those. And this would be manned by project finance experts, which we don't have in state government. We don't have project finance experts. So
it's like having a – I was thinking as you were talking mm-hmm. about it, it's a little bit like going to investment committee with your potential
yes.
investment that you think the fund – I'm referring to the real estate funds I used
yeah.
to work with, but – people on the acquisitions team would come into investment committee and say, I think we should purchase this investment.
Yeah.
And the investment committee would say, okay, tell me all the research you've done and why this is good investment. And they'll give their comments and potentially send the people back to do more research, or they'll bless it on the spot, or they'll say no. So that what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, is that there would be a third party outside of the government that would operate like this investment committee.
Yes.
Would that party also manage the project? Because if let's say you're going there and you're there for 4 years, but the project's going to go on, whatever, 20 years or something like that, who holds accountability for the results?
Well, the board would hold accountability, yes. And they would be appointed by some by the legislature, some by the governor, some by – but they all have to have expertise. These are not like just, you know, political favors that are given out, because they have real responsibility. So it's like having your own consulting firm that actually knows what they're doing. The state of Connecticut has only done one public-private partnership, which is revamping the rest stations along the highways. And fortunately, it worked out okay. But generally, sometimes P3s that states enter, and there's some turn out really badly because they don't have the expertise to negotiate with these very sophisticated, you know, private finance groups. So this would put us on an even playing field that would ensure that we could do P3s and that we wouldn't get our shirts taken off. So this is anyway, but I want to just go back to sort of like the politics of it. So it's originally a Republican idea. Obviously, you know, I am a Democrat, but I don't care where good ideas come from. I just want the good ideas and proven solutions to become our public policy. So interestingly, I did a number of informational sessions for my colleagues up there, and I met with all the agencies because I tried to educate people, and I brought in experts on infrastructure banks over and over again to educate people. And I brought people who run infrastructure banks in Rhode Island and other places to come and testify and talk about how many hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, their states are saving, and they're doing more projects than we're doing. And at the end of the session, when I brought this to the floor, I was grilled by my Republican colleagues for 3.5 hours, and they all voted against it. And all the Democrats voted for it because I had taken all that time to help them understand it and to see the benefits of it, and would also create more jobs because we'd be doing more projects. So it's just an example of how we still have intractable partisanship in Hartford. And it's really important for people to know that, because if we really want to solve our state fiscal crisis and really get the economy growing in a sustainable way, we really have to work together, and we have to break through the partisanship.
Okay, good. Good. I'm glad you're at this point, because it's a more universal issue, which is our political systems, whether it's in Connecticut or in the United States in general, are so polarized right now.
Yeah.
How would you suggest people, because I don't consider myself a Democrat or a Republican necessarily. So how do you get people, or how do you get the politicians to start to think on a more holistic, I think was the word you used, level, which is an ideal. But I really do think more people are open to it than we think.
Yes.
So how do you get more people involved?
Basically, everybody I talk to wants this same outcome. They just want the problems to be fixed. And they really don't care who gets credit, and politicians shouldn't care who gets credit. We should just be doing our job, which is trying to help society advance and to lift everybody up. So, but what's interesting is that, so even though the vote on my particular infrastructure bank bill went right down party lines, it won in the Senate because we have 22, so it was 22-14. The reason it didn't get called for a vote in the House, even though the majority leader loved it, I had all the support I needed there in terms of votes was because, believe it or not, the governor actually blocked it. So so this is what I was saying before. Sometimes you don't – where you, the opposition comes from the place where you least expect it, because he had campaigned and said many, many times that he just wanted public-private partnerships and more government efficiency and accountability, et cetera, et cetera. And this was handing it to him on a silver platter, mm-hmm. and especially for something as important as transportation infrastructure, which we talk about all the time as the linchpin to unlocking economic growth and bringing business back to Connecticut. The reason that he opposed it was simply that the government agencies opposed it. They had sent me a letter. And this is a FOIable public letter saying we will not support this bill if it applies to transportation infrastructure. Of course, that's the reason you need it, is to apply to transportation infrastructure. So it's an example of agencies that are not accountable to the public because they're not – they don't work
what
for the public.
What agencies? You don't have to
– well, this was from the OPM.
OPM,
which is the budget agency.
But, oh, okay.
But I'm
sure. So I'm just asking because I'm not trying to – have you name anything? It's just that I'm just even trying to understand – even how it works, folks, if you're listening, it was maybe you don't want to spend your day looking up Connecticut politics, but if we really care about Connecticut, it's you got to know what's going on. You have to be able to see some of the big picture, and it really is just downloading some information about Connecticut.
Yeah.
And you were also pointing to a document where you could see all the bills that were just.
This is But just to wrap that up, I just want to say the way that really how anything happens, anything good happens, is when people get involved, when the public gets involved, and we shine a light on the good ideas and whatever it is that's stopping the good ideas from moving forward. So I posted actually on social media that this is how good ideas die in Connecticut. You know, somebody's covering for the agency that doesn't want to be accountable. So if people care about that and they want to see solutions move forward, they can contact the governor's office, they can contact me, they can contact their legislators wherever they live. But first they need to be really informed. And so I want to point people to the website, which is cga.ct.gov, G-O-V, that is the best resource for information on what our government is actually doing. And it lists all the committees, all the legislators, what they're responsible for, what happened to every bill. Because just because somebody voted for a bill when it actually came to a vote doesn't mean they actually supported it along the way. So you have to kind of dig deeper and see what people's actions really were. But this is a summary of all of the major acts that we passed in 2019. And I encourage people to read it. It's only about 20 pages long, but it'll give you an idea of what we accomplished, which is a lot, but there's still a lot more to be done.
Did you want to go to break, or how do you want to do this, Bob? You want to go to break? So, folks, this is Noreen Ehrlich. You're listening to Defiant Hustle Radio, and I am fortunate enough to be here this evening with Senator Alex Bergstein. And when we come back from break, don't go anywhere, because we're going to get into some of the bills that were passed, which ones weren't passed, and a lot of other things. So stick with us. This is the kind of radio you should be listening to. This is important for us, Connecticut. Stand by. We'll be right back.
Start here on 95. It's still very slow northbound from exit 7 up to exit 21, seeing about an hour of volume here in Stamford. Also on the Merritt northbound, not looking much better between exit 34 and 46. Very congested there as well. This report sponsored by Unbound.org. A girl in Kenya dreams of becoming a doctor. An elder in Guatemala dreams of being part of a community. Reach out and change your world, and it'll change your own. Unbound.org. I'm Tim Bonomo on 1490 WGCH.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Partly cloudy skies, mild and muggy for tonight. Patchy fog developing after midnight, lows 65 to 70. Independence Day tomorrow, mostly sunny, very warm and humid, 85 to 90. And partly sunny Friday with an isolated afternoon shower near 85. Want your kids to grow and share their talents with professional artists? This summer, go to ypicamp.org for more. Since 1984, they are not just a place, but a state of mind. I'm meteorologist Ryan Gallagher on 1490 WGCH.
What if I told you I could change your life in just 100 days? This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defy and Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and leader in Wall Street's fast-paced private equity industry. I helped guide teams of professionals to improve their careers, grow their businesses, and still maintain work-life balance. Based on this know-how and my unique understanding of life's principles, I created a 100-day plan that will unquestionably up-level your life. Make 2019 your year. You can and deserve to have it all. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at NoreenEhrlich.com or calling me at 475-333-2173.
Radio. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and I am in studio this evening with Senator Alex Bergstein. And so, thank you, of course, for being with me today, Alex. And so, the Senate just submitted different bills to be examined, and we were going to talk about some of what those bills were and what passed and maybe whatever we want to talk about, what didn't, and what was the I was going to say the instinct behind it, but that's not what was the what you go
okay what, oh, all sorry. Right. Well, we were very productive in this legislative session. We did not fix some of the biggest issues in the state, but like transportation infrastructure and unfunded pensions. However, we did get a lot accomplished. So I'd love to just highlight some of the things that we did, which I think are a great start. So for instance, we passed many pro-business policies. We cut the business entity tax. We simplified bureaucracy and red tape for businesses. We passed the Transfer Act so that properties that may have been used for like dry cleaners or other businesses that used heavy chemicals, instead of languishing for years and years and years waiting for the Department of Energy and Environmental Policy to assess them, they have to be assessed within 1 year, remediated, so that property can move freely and business can really
can thrive
exactly. So we're trying to make Connecticut as pro-business as possible. That also includes investing in training a workforce. So we are spending time and money investing in the next generation workforce and in all sorts of vocational training. I was actually really proud and pleased to have originated a bill that passed that gives employers the ability to take credit for tax credits for helping to pay off some student debt.
Oh, I saw that.
Yes. So that is really exciting. And it's the reason that's so exciting, it's great for students. It's also great for employers because they can market themselves that way, that they offer this benefit and attract people to work in their companies. It's also really great for Connecticut real estate because Connecticut has one of the highest rates of student debt, and student debt delays people buying their first home for 7 years. So the Connecticut Realtors Association was very much in favor of this bill, because the more we can unsaddle people's debt, the faster they'll be able to, first of all, contribute to our economy and pay their taxes and buy a house and really become an important part of our growing economy. So we also passed debt-free community college, which is also really great.
Really?
Because, yes.
Debt-free
community college. And also really important is that we have more funding for education than ever before. So our ECS system is fully funded. And that's great, because I think everybody agrees, I hope they agree, that maintaining top quality education, you know, K through 12, it's not only important to our communities and our families, it's also important to the future of our state and attracting people.
Say that one more time. You also passed
Education funding. So
describe it. I'm sorry. Yeah. So education funding.
We have more funding for public school education.
So
this
public
year
school, so K through 12.
Than ever before. Exactly.
Okay, good.
Exactly.
All right, sorry, I'm a little
slow. So we're investing in education. We're investing in workforce development. We are eliminating obstacles for businesses. So, for instance, one great example is that craft breweries had all sorts of restrictions on them before. They couldn't sell off property. They were limited to how much they could sell. They had to get like 5 different kinds of permits in order to sell. We've eliminated a lot of that red tape so that wineries, craft breweries, and other sort of farms and agricultural establishments can sell their products more easily, because that's what we want. We want Connecticut grown products and products developed here to be able to be sold on the market more freely. We want to encourage businesses. So so that's all really great. And also in terms of the tax structure, it's more business friendly than ever before. So
the big corporations,
yeah,
because we always hear, oh, GE left and GE Capital left and what does stop the big corporations? What's the primary reason that big corporations don't move to Connecticut anymore?
Okay. So
that you think is the primary reason.
Well, it's not a question of opinion. It's a question of fact.
Okay.
So the Business Council of Fairfield County, which is a fantastic organization whose mission is to do exactly what you're describing, is to bring companies to Connecticut and retain them here in Fairfield County. So they are the number one resource for understanding what inhibits businesses from moving here. And they have said it loud and clear many times. It's our transportation. It's our congested highways and our trains that are slower today than they were 30 years ago, which is unacceptable. So Joe McGee, who helps run the Business Council of Fairfield County, describes it. He says, you know, companies come to Stanford and they look at these beautiful office buildings and they think, oh, wow. Then they look out at the water and Long Island Sound. It looks so great. It's so enticing. And then they turn and look at 95 at 11 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It doesn't even matter what time it is. It is always bumper to bumper. And they say, no thanks. So that's why I spent a lot of my time talking to CEOs and people who run companies in Stanford to find out what could bring more companies here. And it's always the same answer. It's the transportation. So we need a much better train station and mass transit system in downtown Stanford. I think Stanford really should be the business capital of Connecticut, given its proximity to New York. We need faster trains, those 30-minute trains, Stanford to New York. That's entirely possible. We just have to replace a few bridges, change some signaling systems, and we could have trains that were 15 minutes faster than they are now. That would be a game changer economically. So that's what I mean when I said we made a lot of progress, but we didn't address the biggest issues that are really going to have the most impact, transportation infrastructure.
And does that mean that... like, when does it come up again?
So this is, as you know, I was the first legislator to put forth a bill to bring tolls to Connecticut. Now, you know, saying do you want tolls is like saying do you want, root canal? Uh-huh. Like, nobody wants root canal, but if you haven't been to the dentist in 25 years and you finally go and the dentist says, you need a root canal, or your mouth is going to fall apart and it's going to rot. Like, you do the responsible thing. You get the root canal. And then you are healthy going forward. So that's basically, that's what the state we're in. And we have, because our, as I said before, our infrastructure is the 41st worst in the nation. It's holding us back economically and it's preventing businesses from moving here. So, which in turn makes our real estate prices, real estate values going down. So... The key to all of that is two major pieces. One is, if we had tolls, and again, the only people need to understand, the only three options for bringing in more revenue to the state is raising taxes. Mm-hmm. I am not in favor of raising taxes. Raising debt, so borrowing money, which again is a tax on everybody, mm-hmm. or the third option, which is a user fee. And that's what tolls are. It's a user fee. You use the highway, you pay. There are all kinds of ways to make it fair and equitable for low income, for commuters, et cetera. But a big chunk of the bill, somewhere between 30 and 60% of the bill, is paid for by out-of-staters who are now freeloading off of our highways. So it's new revenue from user fee plus infrastructure bank so that we don't keep pouring money into a system that is not going to deliver the kind of results we need. We need a new mechanism so we get economic impact, we get real cost efficiency, mm-hmm. and we bring in the private sector with their better technology, better systems, lower cost, lower operating cost to do these projects better, faster, cheaper.
And people don't – I know many states are adopting – have adopted tolls or are considering it.
Every state on the East Coast has tolls except for Connecticut.
And even so, Texas.
So you know what's funny? I actually, every time I meet someone who's moved to Connecticut from another state, but they all have tolls. Everybody who moved here from New York or New Jersey, they all have tolls. And I just ask them, I say, did you move to Connecticut because you were fleeing tolls? And they look at me like, I'm crazy. Like, no, in all of those states that have tolls, tolls are not even an issue. Like, it's just a fact of life. Like, if you're going to get on a train, you have to buy a ticket. If you're going to get on a highway, you pay for using that highway. And the benefit, the other benefit of tolls, mm-hmm. is then, and because it's all electronic now.
Actually, so meaning you drive under the tolls, you wouldn't even know.
Right. But is that it would reduce traffic considerably. And here's another, because it's congestion pricing, here's another way to look at it. Once we have the ability to do the electronic tracking of cars, we can also eventually start pricing based on emissions. So this is what really forward-thinking societies are doing. There, if you want to drive, let's say, a diesel truck that's going to pollute, you know, 1,000 times more than whatever it is, a different, more efficient car, you know, that pollution that diesel truck is sending out in the air is breathed in by all of us. It causes asthma and all sorts of chronic diseases in children. It comes at a cost, a real cost to the public, not only environmental cost, but also public health cost. Why should we pay that cost? The person who's producing that should pay. So, for instance, so more polluting vehicles would pay slightly higher, and more efficient, less polluting vehicles would pay lower. The other benefit is once we have the electronic infrastructure in place, we can also start enforcing traffic safety you don't have to have a physical, you know, person giving out tickets for speeding or for going through red lights.
Now you're taking on something that'll be...
Well, you know what? I believe in public safety. I mean, you know, like, we're not all saints. We don't always drive the speed limit, but, you know, unnecessary deaths and accidents, especially in school districts, mm-hmm. because there's no one there enforcing the speed limit, or and people are driving and texting. That could we could resolve that.
So this would be primarily on I-95 and major interstates.
The tolls would only be on four highways, 95, 91, 84, and the Merritt.
Okay, so we're running out of time. All right, so all right. Everybody knows the tolls. I was curious. Yeah. What? Let's go to something. I didn't know what people and I'm not trying to be naive here. Yeah. I know people don't want to be taxed.
Right.
But somewhere, I don't, you know, the CFO in me wants to see the big picture, and I did go look at some things that said where the money comes in from, where the money goes in general, where money comes from in Connecticut or any other state, but in Connecticut, mm-hmm. which is primarily property taxes, mm-hmm. and then where it goes. Mm-hmm. And then at that point, when you're really looking at the big picture, there's a real reality check. Mm-hmm. But so that everybody can't put their foot down at some point, if you care about the state, we're going to have to. Yeah. I don't like the word root canal. It sounds horrible. But you would have to be doing something now, and people.
Right.
I know I'm oversimplifying it, but go into a state, I think, of denial or something like that.
Look, we have to make responsible choices. And what I want people to understand is, there are no simple, easy answers to complex problems that it took years to
develop. We're already in the problem.
Right. But here's some good news, that at the beginning of this session, there were some really bad ideas that were put on the table that would have cost, I think that would have been bad economic policy for the state, and that would have been really bad for our district, like regionalization of schools, like capital gains tax. All sorts of things that we, the fiscally responsible Democrats, pushed back hard on. And because we're now there and we have a seat at the table, and Greenwich hasn't had that for 88 years, mm-hmm. we were able to change the policy. So we truly shifted things away from what it could have been, which is more of sort of a grab from Fairfield County, to something that is much more responsible and disciplined and equitable. So so that's what I meant by we are moving the ship in the right direction, and our voice is finally being heard in Hartford, and it hasn't been heard for a very long time.
It's funny because I use that when I'm – I do – business coaching, executive coaching, but I use people, I say put a new target, but it takes a when you're going in the wrong direction, it takes time to turn the ship.
Yes.
And it can get scary.
Yeah.
It gets scary right away, actually. But is there something else? We've only got a few minutes here, but where can people learn more? Where can people learn more or get more involved?
Yes. I'm so glad you asked that, because that's really what I hope that people will do, is learn more and get more involved, because the more involved you are and the more informed you are, the more impact you have. And really, truly, what makes impact is people being involved, coming up to Hartford, calling me, calling the governor, whoever it is. The public really steers the ship. So one thing that they can do is come to an event that I'm organizing on July 17th. It's called Meet the Senate. I'm going to bring some of my fellow senators down here. I want people to understand what's happening in the rest of the state, and then how we all actually work together for the greater good.
Thank you for coming on the show, Alex. Come on back. I want to keep informing people. And then next week, folks, I have on State Rep Fred Camillo. So he'll be coming on. So my show's gotten a little bit more political, mm-hmm. but I do want people to understand what kind of power they have in politics. So thank you. This is Noreen Ehrlich, and have a great 4th of July weekend. Bye-bye, and thank you, Alex. And thank you, Bob.
Celebrating our nation's independence, this is 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
Administration about face on putting the citizenship question on the census. Correspondent Caitlin Collins reports that attorney told the judge that printing the census forms without